session number 27075, reel 13.
Reel 13.
So I shepherded him inland. He was losing height now fairly steadily. I couldn't see any damage to him. He hadn't got the engines on fire or anything like that. But quite clearly, he was on the way down. So I wanted to make sure he didn't pull a fast one and make off for home unnoticed. But no, he went steadily down. By this time, everything else had been left far behind. They were all still milling around. And he came across, we crossed the coast together. I think we were about 5,000 or 6,000 feet when we crossed the coast. And then he turned to the left and headed due south. But now we're heading towards Rendlesham Forest, a large area of conifers north of Harwich. And in the middle of this large forest, there was quite a large clearing. And evidently the Italian had spotted this as he turned in towards it and started descending quite rapidly. And he just carried on down, got down to about the middle of the field, and he touched the ground. And the aircraft skidded along for quite a few hundred yards, I would say, on its belly, and finished up in the plantation of small conifers. Came to a standstill, which was really the end of the story. There were pictures in the Times the following day, and a write-up and a pictures of the Italian crew. Did I show them to you? There wasn't much more I could do now. I looked at my fuel gauges and found they're alarmingly low. And in the distance, I could see Martlesham Heath Airfield, and I could see aircraft landing there. So the best thing is to go there and get some fuel before I head back to North Weald. So I landed there, taxied in, and all this tremendous excitement. Everybody was rushing around, slapping each other on the back, and it was all very exciting. And another one of our chaps, Sergeant Parrott, he landed there as well. And we were all milling around, and Stanford Tuck came over to me and said, did you get anything? I said, well, I think we all got something. He said, what are you claiming? I said, I'll speak to our intelligence officer, if I may. And we'll see what he decides about it. So that was that. Next morning, yes, they said, actually the weather then closed in. It got very foggy. And they said, you better stay the night here, but not go back to North Weald tonight. So there was a bit of a booze up in the bar then, as you might imagine. It was quite an event. The bit I forgot, of course, was the my bomber was about to reach the safety of the ground, I glanced again up towards the north to see what was going on, and there was this what looked like a cloud of midges milling round in all directions, a whole crowd of them. And there was one or two larger aeroplanes, which undoubtedly were hurricanes, mixed up with this lot. It was all milling around. And this, in fact, turned out to be the fighter escort, which comprised some 40 CR-42 biplanes. Now, this is about the equivalent to our Gloucester Gladiator. Quite a good biplane, I dare say. Very manoeuvrable, and indeed, if you weren't very careful, I can well imagine, you wouldn't get caught out quite nastily with these things that could turn on a sixpence. And although they weren't heavily armed, if any of them were a good shot, you could easily run into trouble. In the event, we didn't have any losses in that action at all. The only damage done, as far as I know, was to their flight commander, 257 Squadron's flight commander, who was leading the formation that day. And he was attacking one of these CR-42s. And whether by design or accident, I don't know, he got too close and hit the aircraft with his propeller. And he got the thing back to the airfield. And this was a source of great excitement. They were all milling around looking at Blatchford's broken propeller. And they said, oh, it's got blood on it, you know. He got the chap all right, no doubt about that. Well, maybe he did. that was the belief at the time.
It must have seemed very strange, actually, to encounter Italians at the tail end of the Battle of Britain in many respects. Because,
well, it was an extraordinary. You see, this is so typical of Mussolini. He was such a vain creature, and he undoubtedly gave orders that the Regia Aeronautica will show the Luftwaffe what it can do and how Britain can be brought to its knees. Extraordinary thing to do.
What was your opinion of their tactics?
Well, I didn't get involved with the escort. Probably just as well. I think, generally speaking, they many of them were good pilots. They were probably good show pilots. Be excellent at an air display, that sort of thing. But they weren't terribly good operationally, I don't think. When we came up against them in Malta, there were always one or two who would mill around a bit. Most of them used to get the hell out of it as quickly as they could. Some of them, when two formations engage each other, some of the Italians would break away and start doing the most beautiful aerobatics. They'd loop the loop and do slow rolls and all sorts of wonderful things, just as if they're doing an air display. I don't know what they meant to achieve. That's not to say they didn't shoot some of us down. They got one or two of us from time to time. But as far as this 11th of November was concerned, this was a one-off. They didn't come again. Well, not surprising. I don't know what the final tally was. I think it was agreed that there were 15 originally. And I think 11 of them were shot down. It's possible that 4 of them did get away. No doubt the intervention of these biplanes saved the last 4 of them. Although, of course, by then most people would have been out of ammunition anyway. However, it was an eventful day.
So you finished with 46 Squadron in December. And where was your posting to?
Yes, that took me down to Tangmere to join 145 Squadron. And I was just getting settled in there nicely. Good squadron.
Again with Hurricanes?
Hurricanes, yes. Very good squadron. Very, very companionable, likeable chaps, all of them. They'd had a fairly tough time a couple of days before I arrived. They'd had got involved with some Messerschmitts off the Isle of Wight, and they'd had some losses. But they were a good outfit, and Tangmere was a nice place to be. There were some nice nurses along the road at the hospital. And yeah, it was all very agreeable. Sad to say, I'd been there 5 or 6 days when the squadron commander sent for me and said, there's some new squadrons being formed to try and cope with the night bomber raids that we're having all over the country. But they've decided to form some more squadrons, new squadrons. And you're going up to join one of them. Well, this turned out to be 96 Squadron, which is forming at a place called Cranage, which is not far from Crewe. Equipped with Hurricanes, painted black, they weren't cannon. No, they were still. We still had eight machine guns. And so there we were, and I was on my way. Regretfully, I didn't quite know what to make about the night flying bit. I'd only flown a half a dozen hours at most at night. However, it was deemed that I had enough night flying experience to become a founder member of the new Night Fighter Squadron.
Would there have been some pilots during that period who wouldn't have had no night flying experience?
I think everybody would have done at least an hour or two somewhere along the line at flying school. But in the schools I was at, And I now realise that these particular schools were aimed at training would-be fighter pilots. And therefore, night flying wasn't apparently not regarded as an important part of the syllabus. I dare say schools that were geared towards multi-engine pilots who would undoubtedly be doing night flying. I dare say they did more night flying. But there we were. I was a bit surprised, I must say, because it seemed to me that half a dozen hours night flying wasn't really much of a qualification to become a night fighter pilot. However, there we were. Arrived at Cranage. It was a small grouse airfield with a navigation school on it. They got ensigns, lots of ensigns, and they used to climb in these and go and do their navigation training. And we were put down the other end of the airfield where they'd built a wooden hut, two wooden huts, and there were our newly black painted Hurricanes standing in a row, and the chaps came together. The CO was a wonderful character, known throughout the Air Force as Boozy Kellett. Great character. And he was the first squadron commander in 96.
How did he get that nickname?
Sorry?
How did he get that nickname?
Well, it must have been something to do with his visitations to the bar, I should think. Yes, he was quite a case, Boozy. He was a good chap, actually. Mad as a hatter. And there was my flight commander was a New Zealander by the name of Rayburn. Then we had a Czech. We had two Czechs, Vasily and Klabushnik, Czech called Mann, another New Zealander from 43 Squadron, can't quite remember his name,
It sounds a real mix of nationalities.
Well, that's right.
By this
it was. It was a mixed lot, undoubtedly geared to bring together people with night flying experience. I think one or two of them had done quite a lot of night. One or two of them had, but I think the majority they'd done more than I had. I think they're probably probably done about 15, 20 hours, that sort of thing. Raybone was a short service regular. I think he'd done a fair bit. Undoubtedly, Boozy himself, he'd done a lot of. I mean, he goes way back to the 30s, early 30s. He was quite experienced night flying pilot. So there we were, getting things together, and it wasn't long before the raids started. I think the first raid that we were involved with was on Liverpool, and Craneage was a bit too far south to cover Liverpool properly. So one flight to which I belonged was moved up to Squires Gate, which is Blackpool Airport. And it was belonged to Vickers. They were building aircraft there. And so we started our night flying operations. Well, from the outset, it was pretty clear that we were biting off rather more than we were going to be able to chew, because the Hurricane had nothing at all in the way of navigational aids or equipment. We had a VHF radio, and that was all. And with the radio, we would communicate with the ground controllers, whose job it was to put us into a position to make an attack on an enemy bomber. But of course, it all hinged upon one's ability to see an aircraft in a dark sky. On a pitch black night when there's no moon, it was a virtual impossibility to expect any form of contact at all. Even as on the one night, when there was a huge fire going in Liverpool, and the glare was such that it lit everything up all around, and you'd think it would be quite easy to spot an aircraft against all that glare. But I didn't. And, I think there was only one chap who did, and that was one of the Czechs, Klebushnik, and he did. He did see a Heinkel 111 and closed in on it, and the gunner, rear gunner, spotted him before he got a chance to get in position and hit him, and he got a bullet right through his chest. At least it glanced across the front of his chest, and he managed to get back to Craneage and land, and the doc happened to be dispersed at the time, and he put him on the table immediately and opened him up, and there was smoke coming out of the wound. They said, "Oh, it was an incendiary bullet." So yeah, so that was the only, while I was there, that was the only contact.
What was the procedure for the control getting you onto the German aircraft?
Yes, well, we had radar, of course, and the controllers would make use of the radar. We hadn't got ground control interception at this time. All we got was the good old-fashioned chain home radar and the plotting board in the control room. So the controller would sit up there on his balcony and look down at the plots and try best he could to bring one plot into a position behind an enemy plot. Later on, of course, radar was introduced into aircraft, and it made all the difference in the world. John Cunningham, of course, was one of the founders of the radar-equipped night fighter force, primarily Blenheims. They did use Havocs, which is a night fighter version of the Boston. But the arrival of the Beaufighter with its radar, of course, did make a huge difference, and quite a few enemy aircraft were shot down by that means. But we had nothing at all, and the best the controller could do would be to say, to give you a height, which he hoped was about right. He could give you Angels 12, whatever. He could give you a course to steer, which hopefully would bring you around behind the enemy aircraft. And he could give you an approximate distance between yourself and the enemy. So the controllers could see the radar blips from the enemy aircraft, and we had what's called an IFF, which is Identification Friend or Foe. And this is a little black box, which when it's switched off, gives a blip which can be seen on a radar screen. And that's what they depended upon to bring our blip around behind the enemy blip on the radar. But it was a good idea to suppose that we would be able to see enemy aircraft at night if the conditions were right, certainly in bright moon conditions. Especially as a layer of cloud and you're above looking down on the enemy aircraft against the glare of cloud, one would think you could see them without any difficulty, but certainly I never saw a single enemy aircraft at night, and very few chaps did. So it was all it was about all we could do at the time.
Would the Germans fly individually or in a bomber stream?
No, they were singles all the time. I never heard them flying in formation at night. Hollywood have you believe that they did, but it wasn't so.
You've obviously said how difficult it was to see aircraft at night. How difficult was it actually flying your aircraft at night?
Just navigating a way around. Quite difficult. To begin with, we were just sent off singly, one at a time, with a time interval between each one, 5-10 minutes. And wherever the raid was going, we'd hustle up there as quickly as we could. Fortunately, the Germans did tend to pinpoint a particular target, which we weren't quite sure until the raid had developed what it was going to be. But generally, it was going to be it was Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham. That it was, I think, more often than not, it was Liverpool. And there's quite a few raids on Manchester. So we just get in the air and get up through the cloud and set off in the general direction of Manchester or wherever. Anti-aircraft fire, of course, was fairly helpful. That soon gave you a pinpoint of where the big cities were. Searchlights were used fairly extensively, so they would give you an idea where things were. But there was no question of map reading or anything like that. You would simply be told to patrol Manchester at 10,000-15,000 feet and try and get there and carry on your patrol.
Would you patrol over the city?
unless the guns, if the guns had got, it was called guns free or guns tight, and guns free meant what it said, or guns tight meant you were clear to go in. But you'd only get guns tight if you were actually latched onto an enemy aircraft and he was going in towards the gunfire. Then they might switch off the guns. But I never had, I was never lucky enough to even pick up an enemy aircraft to follow in.
Did you do anything to attempt to prove your night vision?
Yes, this was quite a regular feature. There was the bit about carrots, of course. We were all fed carrots wildly. We would sit in a darkened room with... we could sit in a lightened room with darkened...
What, a mask or glasses or...
Yes,
chains?
Yes. Either that, or more sensibly, just to sit in a dark room, didn't need the masks. But the silliest thing and the worst thing we could possibly do would be to sit in a lighted room, maybe reading or playing shove openly or something. And the moment you step outside, you're in pitch black. And as you know, it does take a few minutes before you've got much in the way of night vision after you've been in a lighted room. But we had these goggle things which were darkened over, and we'd sit and put them on. Actually, I did rate quite highly on night vision. I think great things were expected. I'm sorry to disappoint.
was the problem really then purely with the interception of the aircraft?
Well, yes. Picking it up and seeing it, being able to see it, that was the difficulty. And indeed, people who were successful enough to actually pick up an enemy aircraft, the difficulty then was getting yourself in a position where you could fire at it. In the meantime, if you weren't very careful, you'd lose him again. He'd just slip out of your vision. The only thing you could hope for was to pick up his exhaust flare, which does work to a certain extent. If you're in the right position, you can see these exhaust steps. I did see them one night over Tripoli. I was in a night fighter squadron there. And I did see an American. It was an RAF Baltimore. And I did spot him against the moon. He just happens to come into the moon. It wasn't all that far away, a few hundred yards, I dare say. The moment he went out of the moon, of course, he'd back into darkness. But I could see his flares, the exhaust flares. And I chased after him to make quite sure that he was what I thought he was, a Baltimore, and indeed it was. But yes, that was the one and only time I saw these exhaust stubs.
Would the Germans have any navigation aids to get them to?
Yes, they did have. They had the beam. And it was quite effective. But thank goodness Professor Jones from somewhere in Welsh Wales, I'm not quite sure where, Professor Jones, who was an expert on radio, and he bent the beam. You probably heard about Jones the beam bender. He did just that, and there was no doubt there were quite a lot of enemy bomb tonnage did go down on open countryside, because he'd managed to divert the bombers from the targets they were after. But that was their main navigational aid. I don't know what else they had. They'd always got a loop, I noticed, radio loop for direction finding. They hadn't got much in the way of radar in those days, of course, 1940, they hadn't got radar operational as far as I know. Of course, their targets were relatively easy to find. Anything on the coastline, of course, Southampton or Portsmouth, Liverpool, Glasgow, you name it, and any of these shore ports in there, any of these ports were quite easy to find. But we, in our Hurricanes, relied on the VHF. And the controllers could take us to where a raid was taking place.